Chapter 13 Prashanti Nilayam. After about a week at the ashram, we were told that those leaving soon would be permitted to meet with Baba. Thinking we would not be able to endure the physical discomfort much longer, 8 of us made arrangements for an interview. At the appointed time one evening, we were ushered into a small room, where we sat on the floor in a semicircle. Baba came in, and closing the circle, directed himself to each of us. Once again, being in his presence made us forget all discomfort. Suddenly we were joyful. Then his manner changed. He became distant and detached, impersonal. He materialized some vibhuti. After a long silence, he began directing himself to each of us again, but strangely, looking over our heads, smiling at times. He would ask an individual's name, and then appear to be off in a dream, nodding back and forth, smiling and laughing, as if he were talking with an imaginary person. At times, he moved his hand, palm up, in a slow circle, then would make a strange motion with his fingers, as if writing in the air. When someone asked him what he was doing, he said that the closest we could come to understanding was that he was reading people's minds and talking to his devotees. He did this with almost everyone in the group, and although he didn't speak personally to any of us, we simply enjoyed being in his presence. He did make some predictions that my brother's wife would become pregnant soon, and that she would have a girl, that she already had a boy, and similar comments to others present. This is exactly what did happen. My brother and sister-in-law already had a handsome son, David, and shortly after the trip, Nancy became pregnant and now has a lovely daughter named Deborah. Baba then asked Donald if he would like to see him alone, and they went into a private area behind a curtain. They were there for a few minutes and then reappeared, my brother looking somewhat sheepish and uncomfortable, and Baba beaming, filled with joy. He said we could leave and that he would see us again in the morning for personal interviews. Outside, my brother said Baba had taken him into the room and hugged him, then asked, "Are you frightened?" Donald answered that he felt a bit awkward, and Baba said not to, and hugged him again. Donald was confused, not knowing how to interpret or react to Baba's actions. His mind was being turned inside out. "I just can't understand why everyone doesn't yell, 'Uncle,' and leave." Don was amazed by the stamina of the Westerners who are able to persevere in such a primitive setting. Every once in a while, when I'd see my brother sitting quietly, dazed by the sun, I'd ask him how he was doing. "I'm not saying uncle yet," was his standard reply. I never knew, though, whether this would be said with a smile or muttered through clenched teeth. The morning after our interview, we awoke quite early after an uncomfortable night on the concrete floor, our cheap air mattresses having developed leaks days before. My brother raised himself on his elbows, rolled over, and tapped me on the shoulder. I opened one eye and saw him pull himself laboriously toward me. There was quiet for a few seconds. Then I heard in a rasping, just awakened whisper, "Uncle." "What's that, Donald?" I asked. "You heard me, uncle." There was another silence, and then he continued, "You know, I can't figure it out. I've been watching Paul for the past week, lying over there under his mosquito netting, sweating and sick with some kind of dysentery, and still he sticks it out. How can people do that? Donald raised himself up again on one arm. Paul! There was a stir from across the room. I can't understand why you haven't called Uncle yet. Paul stirred again. Do you know where I can catch the next cab out of here? We prepared ourselves hastily for the upcoming interviews, then, after breakfast, stationed ourselves by the temple and waited. Before long, we were directed into a small back room and arranged ourselves again in a semicircle at the foot of Baba's chair. I was stationed just to the right of the chair, and Sharon next to me. Baba came in beaming, setting his usual mood of love and openness. He began by speaking a little with us, and then briskly whirled his hand in the air to produce a huge mound of candy, rising 4 or 5 inches above his palm. He distributed a goodly portion to each of us. I felt transformed into a child sitting at the feet of Santa Claus in some magnificent fairy tale, and I might add that I've seen the sternest, hardest, the most pompous people become children at Baba's feet. He called my brother over to him and asked him to sit at his right in front of me. His eyes twinkled as he asked Don what he wanted. Then he moved his hand and materialized a beautiful ring made of a heavy metal with small gold figurines of his pet elephant Saigita on each side and a gold figure of Baba on its face. He placed the ring on Donald's finger and it fit perfectly. Donald beamed. I felt choked and Sharon began to cry. I was so happy that Baba should present such a fine gift to my brother, showing him such love, demonstrating to all of us his great power, that I could hardly hold back my own tears. Baba told him that he would have a long, healthy, and happy life and be a very good doctor. Then people began asking Baba questions. How would we know when he is with us when we are far away? He turned to one woman in the group, someone he hadn't spoken to yet. Quote, "She knows when Baba is with her," end quote. And all of a sudden she became flushed with excitement and began to cry. Later she related the story of how she had first become aware of Baba's presence back in the United States. Against the advice of her family, she had taken her mother out of a convalescent home to nurse at home. She did this out of love, even though it was a trying and difficult task. Her mother was incontinent and in need of much attention, but the daughter looked after her with great devotion. As time went on, she would enter her mother's room, and spontaneous and inexplicable waves of emotion would sweep through her. She had no idea what was causing this to happen, although she sensed the presence of someone unknown but close to her and identified the emotion as love. When she heard of the Sai Baba meetings held by Elsie Cowan and decided to attend one. Going for the first time, she met Elsie, who happened to hand her a piece of material from one of Baba's robes. She touched it and was suddenly electrified, experiencing an almost convulsive state of ecstasy. Now, in the interview with Baba, she was certain that he was aware of her experience and was referring to it. Baba began to materialize other objects and to talk knowingly to people about themselves and gave advice. In response to a woman's complaint of problems with her eyes, he materialized a medallion, telling her to immerse it in water and to place a few drops of the water in her eyes every day. Baba then saw each of us separately. Lila requested something for which she had been praying for a number of months. He responded by stepping back playfully, his eyes twinkling, his face a broad, loving smile, and answered her in the very words which she had been using in her prayers to him. He simply had had no way of knowing what those words had been, and she was overwhelmed. To my wife's concerns and wishes for our children, Baba responded with a discussion which he felt reflected awareness of their individual personalities, and he materialized the medallion for one of them. He told me not to worry about money matters, and talked to me about my spiritual development, aware that he knew my deepest yearnings and aspirations. I was filled with bliss. In answer to my question about spending time with him, he said, quote, "First, you have to attend to your duty back home. You will be freer after your children are grown," end quote. When we were sitting together again, Baba moved his hand in the air and brought out 8 little calling cards with his picture and address and handed one to each of us. "He was with us always," he said. After much encouragement and love, he gave out packets of vibhuti. As usual, although the materializations during the interview were impressive, for me the major impact came from his uncanny awareness of each of us and his ability to show me that he is indeed literally with us even when physically absent. This concrete experience of the omnipresence of a loving being, an experience which continues right through one's life, filling it with a deep sense of security and safety, is a most miraculous gift. A number of questions were answered by this trip. Why Baba, for example, supposedly so great and powerful, would allow such uncomfortable living conditions to exist in his ashram? That initially perplexed me, and I finally resolved it in this manner. Perhaps it was unfair to judge the conditions of the ashram at this time, for we were there during a period of construction with many obstacles to personal comfort normal in such a situation. Even so, no one was turned away, and all were there free of charge. Then, too, the experience of suffering is widespread in the world, yet to my thinking, this certainly is no argument against the existence of God. It is now obvious to me that we ourselves have the responsibility to choose right over wrong, good over bad, and that the situations in which we find ourselves are due to our own actions, whether in this life or perhaps even in past lives. It is our responsibility to serve and heal ourselves. I'm beginning to appreciate the concept of karma. We reap what we sow. We are repaid in like for the good and bad that we do. We are entirely responsible for pulling ourselves out of the mess that we have made for ourselves, and it is foolish and futile to try to shift responsibility to someone else. It is so easy to get caught up in the excitement of Baba with all the changes one makes in his conceptions of the nature of reality and all the blows to one's previously held beliefs that we may begin to feel that he will take care of everything exactly as we wish, not just on the spiritual level, but on the physical plane as well. When the landmarks of old realities are taken from us, many of us flounder about quite lost, trying to hold fast to God for direction. At this stage, it is easy to lose one's sense of perspective and responsibility. So it is with us when we expect Baba to assume responsibility for cleaning up the ashram by waving a magic wand and suddenly making everything pure and beautiful. It is more apparent to me now that Baba's appearance on earth is to give people faith in the existence of a higher reality and the truth of spiritual laws, so that we may have the strength to turn toward righteousness and steadfastly work to better our condition. If some great force cured all our illness and poverty, but left us at our present level of consciousness, we would soon be at one another's throats again, and the same chaotic situation would develop in the world. I'm learning a great deal more about yogic powers or siddhis. Many yogis and Baba himself have stated that these powers frequently deter one from the spiritual path. I have now seen people get caught up in the fascination with them and lose sight of the ultimate goal of merging with God. Baba reminds us that the spiritual leader as well as the seeker can fall prey to this temptation. But Sai Baba admonishes us not to consider him a spiritual aspirant who can still yield to such lower tendencies. His feats are simply part of his very nature, he says, because he is an avatar, beyond karma and evil, beyond space and time, beyond classification of any kind, beyond duality. His powers are simply an outer expression of the reality of his being merged with everything, everywhere, at all times. In speaking of the extraordinary feats which millions call miracles, Baba has said, quote, "They belong to the natural, unlimited power of God and are in no sense the product of siddhic powers as with yogis, or of magic as with magicians. The creative power is in no way contrived or developed, but is natural only. Swami creates some objects in just the same way that he created the universe. Certain other objects are brought from where they were. There are no invisible beings helping Swami to bring things. His sankalpa, his divine will, brings the object in a moment. He is everywhere." End quote. Most people with paranormal powers know their limitations. The extent of their powers can be defined. They usually feel that they are channels or mediums in touch with a higher reality, perhaps used by it, and in any case, usually humbled by their relationship to it. In contrast, Baba's powers appear to be boundless. He states that not only are there other dimensions of reality and levels of consciousness, a way to greater awareness, but that he is, in fact, these other dimensions and the path to them. There is no separation between him and any dimension, or between him and you and me. Even with his immense power, there is no semblance of pompous show or image-building behavior on Baba's part, only giving, teaching, loving. In all my personal and professional experience with people and my awareness of motivation, I have never seen anyone behave this way. It is the most moving miracle I have ever witnessed. I am also becoming aware of the nature of what in Sanskrit is called maya, the illusionary nature of what we call and consider reality, how our sense perceptions, our thoughts, and our emotions orient us to the world in a way that is purely illusion, that senses and feelings have a way of blurring or tunneling our vision, seducing us from the spiritual path, was concretely pointed out to me by the way my feelings of physical discomfort and my reaction to the disease, poverty, and primitiveness of Puttaparthi almost tricked me out of my appreciation of Sai Baba's greatness. Many people coming to Baba are put through trying ordeals by which they learn the futility and frustration that comes from wanting. Some are so hurt that they become angry with Baba and turn away. For most, however, when confronted with a choice of giving up either their wants or Sai Baba, it becomes apparent that it isn't Baba who must go, but the wanting. It became clear to me that I was not supposed to be living at Prashanti Nilayam, that I was supposed to find a way of establishing my relationship with Baba while continuing to live and work in America. I had heard Baba speak about this frequently, not to disrupt oneself and take to the woods or a cave in the mountains for seclusion, but to continue with one's duty where one happens to be of service, and to develop the relationship with Baba by putting more and more of his teachings into practice in the midst of one's daily life. I was beginning to see that Baba is much greater than his physical form. He is more truly his teaching, his love, his truth, his caring. I had begun to see the futility of trying to get close to him physically, and to recognize that if I want true contact with him, I must accomplish this by merging with him on a spiritual level. I must weave his teachings and his spirit ever more coherently into the fabric of my life until I become him.